Welcome to the Growing Rural Podcast, where we focus on all things rural in South Carolina. We will discuss topics on healthcare, economy, education, and the unique culture that is our rural state. This podcast is supported by the South Carolina Center for Rural and Primary Healthcare. Please join us for today's topic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Growing Rural Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kevin Bennett. Our guest today is Dr. Barnett Berry, research professor and founding director of All4SC within the University of South Carolina. Welcome.
Great to be here, Kevin.
So, Barnett, tell us a little bit about yourself and just how you got to be where you are right now.
Educator, researcher, perhaps more of a advocate than a scholar, but still pretty much a student of the teaching profession and public education, and wanting very much to improve it for now, I think, around 35 years.
35 years. So advocate for?
Better schools for kids, more opportunities for kids to have a better life, and better opportunities for those who work most closely with them, teachers. To lead their profession and to lead school reform and not just be the targets of one program after another, after another, after another.
Right. And obviously education reform is a hot topic right now.
It's hot. It's been hot. It's been kind of going a certain way for at least 30 or 40 years, and it hasn't worked out so well.
For the kids and students and teachers?
Most definitely. Even though our schools are probably better than they've ever been, we're getting better results than we've ever had before in many ways, given the challenges, circumstances that kids, parents, and educators are facing. But here's the bottom line. Schools haven't changed very much in the last 30 or 40 years. What industry, whether it's in medicine, technology, you name it, automobile, it's changed a great deal. And pretty much the way the bells are rung, the school year, the calendar, the job responsibilities of teachers.
All that's been pretty static.
Pretty static.
Right. Now, so, there are things that have come along, like Common Core and things like that. Those aren't, you don't consider those large changes, or?
No, they're always, they're marginal.
Marginal.
They're pretty marginal changes. A lot of good stuff, but it doesn't have much coherence, Kevin.
Okay.
And by the way, that's what All4SC is about.
Okay.
Trying to bring greater coherence and alignment of people and programs, time, talent, and treasure that we already have in the system from the university as well as the school system and the community to better the lives of young people and their parents.
Okay, so tell us more about that and where that, how that started and where it came from.
Well, in some ways, it started just a couple of years ago. In many ways, I feel like it started for me when I first was a teacher at Eau Claire High School in the early 80s. But I had the good fortune of returning to my home state 2 years or so ago, doing some work that my nonprofit was engaged in with the state Department of Education here around school reform and actually empowering educators to lead the reform, as I just suggested. And I had the good fortune when I returned to meet or re-meet or reconnect with one John Peterson, then dean of the, and still is, the College of Education. Thank goodness he still is the dean of the College of Education. We started having a really good conversation about how to take some of the work that we were both interested in to another level. And about the time we were talking about how to bring together a more coherent system of what I like to now call teaching, learning, and caring.
Okay.
Then president of the university, Harris Pastides, announced the Excellence Initiative, of which faculty members and their partners had a chance to compete for some internal funds to for two purposes. One, to fuel innovation inside the university and to better lives of South Carolinians.
Okay.
Bunch of proposals were written, and All4SC was one that we came up with, and I helped pin that proposal. And lo and behold, about a year and a half later, it was funded, and we're off and running.
So this is not just a University of South Carolina initiative. This is for the entire state?
It is anchored in the University of South Carolina, but right. if we do it well, mm-hmm. and we better darn well do it well, it will not be a U of SC thing.
Right.
It will be a state thing and hopefully be a national thing.
Gotcha.
And it is a simple proposition.
Mm-hmm.
How can the assets of the entire university,
mm-hmm.
and I like to say from medicine to music and from education to engineering and everything in between,
mm-hmm.
how can all those assets come together to support the needs of our highest need rural communities
right.
in South Carolina? But not defined by us at the university, Kevin,
mm-hmm.
defined by those in the community.
Right, because that's often an issue even in healthcare, well, maybe especially in healthcare. There's a, you know, the white coats come in to save the day, or the sitting from the ivory tower telling communities what to do. But it sounds like you're letting the communities tell you what they need.
Yes, and then how can we marshal our assets to okay. support what they want to get done?
Okay.
How do we open up opportunities for all of us to learn together?
Mm-hmm.
And that includes now the scholar in me is coming out.
Mm-hmm.
How do we actually do scholarship a little bit differently too? And it's not just about university folk studying the phenomena.
Right.
But how do we roll up our sleeves together and co-design the kinds of evidence that we want to build
right.
to both improve what we're trying to get done,
mm-hmm.
as to improve better outcomes for young people.
Right.
But also contribute to the field.
Right, so that others can replicate it and learn from it?
Well, replicate, maybe, but okay. maybe not. Our vision for scale, because it deals with complex human phenomena,
mm-hmm. right.
We're thinking more, less about replication and adoption of what we learn how to do and hopefully learn how to do it well, and how to help others adapt and reinvent it.
Mm, okay.
So it's a little bit different model for scaling, right. and it has a lot to do with the complexity of what we're doing. Here's the cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that needs to be done is being done somewhere. And mm-hmm. I would say even in South Carolina.
Right.
But no place have we put all the pieces of the puzzle together.
Right.
How can a university, which has been designed to work in silos,
right? Yes,
even
is.
Inside our schools of medicine and colleges of education, there's
yes.
so many silos. How can we begin to figure out how to put these pieces of those puzzle together in mm-hmm. the service of the need of a community?
Right.
And then how do we tell the story?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how do we build the evidence? And then how do we tell the story so others, again, can do this type of work? This is a 5-year journey at a minimum.
Right.
It's a
right.
10-year, 20-year journey to really begin to realize all that we seek to
right.
achieve.
And especially that's one of the challenges I would assume with education is the outcomes are so long-term.
Yes. And folks who want to put money into this, and thank goodness the president, and by the way, President Bob Caslin is just as enthusiastic
mm-hmm.
Around this idea, and we're enjoying working with him. But most folks who invest in education want results yesterday.
Right, right.
And we're just not going to have them yesterday.
And I imagine there might be some things that you could do quickly, like reducing truancy or improving attendance to a degree.
Or how about improving better nutritional opportunities for kids and,
right, right.
and getting better cafeteria food.
Right.
And not so much better cafeteria food, because there's some good stuff going on in communities like Fairfield in terms of feeding children.
Mm-hmm.
But we know about 8 in 10 kids there are food insecure.
Right. So what are they doing on the weekends?
And they're not. And, right. and by the way, things can be better
mm-hmm.
In terms of opportunities for kids to get better nutrition.
So you mentioned empowering educators to drive the reform. So what does that look like? What are some of the things that have percolated up that way?
Well, I mean, here in South Carolina, around the country, around the world, this is a big issue because if you're going to drive the transformation of communities through kind of a whole child approach to education, teaching, learning, and caring,
mm-hmm.
that means particularly those professionals who are with the children the most, and that's
mm-hmm.
a K-12 teacher.
Right.
There are a lot of other people in their lives, parents and other support providers, but for about 180 days a year,
they're in front of that student.
Seven, yep. 8 hours a day or more, right?
Right. It's a lot of exposure.
It's a lot of exposure, like, yep. yeah, a lot of hours. And so if those folks don't have opportunities to work with other professionals, if they don't have an opportunity to work with university folk in these research practice partnerships, mm-hmm. if they don't have an opportunity to actually identify some of the priorities, and most importantly, engage in the kind of inquiry to determine whether or not the solutions that we are trying to adapt mm-hmm. are working or not. If they're not doing all those things while still teaching children,
right,
then we're not going to get where we need to be. Now, I'm not saying that teachers need to do more, mm-hmm. but they need to have different roles, and we need to think about all the people in the system mm-hmm. that need to be realigned so that teachers can lead more mm-hmm. because others are doing more with them.
Right, right. So take what they already have and reconfigure it somewhat.
Yeah, most teachers do almost every job imaginable inside the four walls of their classroom.
Right. Especially when you're talking a rural school system.
Correct. Right. Now, think about, I'm in the School of Medicine with you, Kevin, right now.
Right.
If we trained and expected doctors and nurses to work that way and not as a team with mm-hmm. hundreds of other specialists
right.
with varying degrees of professional preparation, specialty, and so forth, if we expected a doctor to do all the things that a teacher needs to do or expect to do in that inside that four-wall classroom, mm-hmm. you think we have a doctor shortage now or a nursing shortage now? You just wait to see what happens.
You actually just described the role of a physician in a primary care physician in a rural area where they pretty much have to do everything,
right?
Which is why we have a shortage in rural areas,
right?
Because it's hard to do.
So we need more incentives for both doctors, right. nurses, and teachers to be in rural areas. We also exactly. need to make their job much more doable.
Right.
The job of a teacher today is absolutely just undoable. And right. that's why we have the shortages that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what are some things that, especially rural communities, what can they do to help lead this reform, improve their systems, help their teachers, all those types of things?
Well, here's what rural communities have, particularly Fairfield.
Mm-hmm.
Over 100 churches. Everyone goes to church on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
Very rich ethos of family related in that community as well. I think there's something that a real huge asset that rural communities have that we don't find in our urban
right.
communities and neighborhoods. And I think we need to draw upon that sort of asset in mm-hmm. trying to bring some of these kind of comprehensive sort of strategies together.
So in doing some of the reading around what you've published, I came across this phrase, community-based schooling. Can you tell me more about what that is?
What it really is about, what my colleague and friend, who's a superintendent in Fairfield, J.R. Green, likes to say, it's about collective responsibility. Just for those in your audience, Kevin might not know this, but about 60 to 80% of the variance or differences in student achievement in a public school system is due to out-of-school factors.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, yeah.
So just even if you got the very best teachers and the very best curriculum in place, you're still not going to be able to get the outcomes that you are seeking without more than just the educators involved in the education
mm-hmm.
Of young people. So mm-hmm. how do you bring the assets of a community together
mm-hmm.
in rethinking not just curriculum but also schedules, after school programming, mm-hmm. so it's more coherent with what goes on in the 7:30 to 3 o'clock day.
Mm-hmm.
How do you bring the disparate services around physical and mental health needs into the school? But how do you also do it in a more integrated fashion? So when the telehealth services or the dental van or the vision support services that might be in the school mm-hmm. or the housing assistance mm-hmm. people are in the school, they're part of the conversation and the action planning of the educators in the building too. So the services have become much more integrated into what, kind of the vernacular here, into what the 2+2=4 operation needs to be. So it's not just we teach kids over here in one corner of the building, and then on another corner of the building, we're providing these additional services.
So trying to integrate and do it at the same time.
Now, the cool thing is, over the last number of years, I would say about decade or so, there's been a growth in what's called community schooling. And there are about 5,000 schools that are operating in this way in this country. And there's about 100,000 schools in this country. So we're still at 5% here.
Right.
So, but more and more of these schools are coming together and trying to bring the resources together in order to get better outcomes for kids. Someone asked me, I'll just quickly, you might be interested in this. Someone asked me the other day, I was in a meeting and said, what would be success like for you? And I said, well, I could start reeling off in about 5 years the kind of outcomes around health and academics and post-secondary achievement, or maybe kids even after high school are earning jobs are paying $25, $30 an hour.
Livable wage, in other
words. Because of their skills related to advanced manufacturing that they learn in high school, which they can't. So I reeled off those kind of outcomes and the like. I said, but next year, this time, let's say March of 2021, I have 5 or 6 different organizations that have put their people and some of their dollars together to start getting some of this work done together. If we start, if in 13 months from now, if we could have some of that going on, I think we'd be doing pretty
darn
well.
That's a big success, right?
Yeah.
So has that type of, community-focused for schooling, that seems to be almost a throwback to the way it used to be? Is that accurate to say?
Oh, my goodness. And when you say that, it puts a big smile on my face. I think about the one-room schoolhouse.
Right.
Where, by the way, the curriculum was so driven by the peer relationships that the teacher cultivated because he or she, well, back then it was, there was he's early on, and then it was all about women being teachers, right, in this country.
Right.
But they couldn't get the job done. They couldn't teach a K-12 curriculum without the assistance of young people helping their peers, their younger peers.
Because it was a mixed classroom in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah.
The full gamut, right.
So I will tell you, that reminds me too, one of the emerging priorities of All for SC through our work in Fairfield is around youth development and mentoring. Because kids cannot become what they cannot see. And what they cannot see, they really cannot believe.
Right. So what are some reforms that you've seen work in rural, small, under-resourced communities here or nationally?
Well, I've seen, for example, some marvelous uses of technology so that teachers who may be a bit underprepared, particularly in STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics areas, because it's so hard to find fully qualified, certified, prepared folks in those fields, have folks who may be kind of a little bit behind the academic eight ball in terms of their preparation and qualifications. I've seen how through online communities of support and practice.
For the educator.
For the educators, that they get the kinds of opportunities to grow and develop into the skilled teachers that they need to be for their students. Simultaneously, I've seen kids have access to terrific opportunities, not just on the academic side, but even on this mentoring side.
Right.
There are extraordinary opportunities. I mean, every kid's on a smart device. I know I am at my advanced age.
Right.
But, why don't we use these devices for, for good and for educational purposes and even mentoring purposes. So I've seen some efforts around the country where strong relationships are built between adults or near peers of relationships so that young people in these rural communities can have access to ideas and the people and the expertise that they would not have otherwise.
Interesting, yeah. So like a distance educator almost.
Yes.
Interesting.
You mentioned, Kevin, community-based schooling. We really haven't done a job that needs to be done yet in preparing educators, particularly administrators, for this kind of reconfigured schooling, where the...
I mean, the interaction with the community and resources.
Okay. And we also... I mean, not in just terms of the kind of adaptive changes that need to be made, but some technical ones, like how do you change the schedule?
Right.
So
that organizational.
So teachers have more time to both teach and lead without working 80 hours a week.
Right.
How do you integrate community supports inside of a very complex, already complex enterprise?
Right.
How do you build the capacity of teachers for this type of work? All those sorts of things have not been the province of most of our preparation programs.
Because you're traditionally teaching educational methods or administrator management, that kind of thing, not all
and,
these other
And basically, areas. We're also we generally teach administrators, even when we do a good job on the educational management side, we teach them to run schools as they are today, not how they need to be tomorrow. Now, don't get me wrong. We prepare administrator. They need to be able to run a school tomorrow.
Right, absolutely.
But at the same time, they've got to have the bandwidth, the wherewithal, the mindset.
And the skills.
Skills and their own network and mentors.
Right.
To rethink a school day, a school year, a calendar in ways that are commensurate with community-based schooling.
Right. And then I believe there's also an issue, you know, you get a good administrator in a rural district, they often tend to leave.
Right.
And they go to larger systems, pays better, better opportunities for spouses or children or those kinds of things, right?
Yes. And this is why All for SC in our 5 to 10 year journey is anchored in four pillars. We've been talking a bit already today about pillars one and two, which is one is the community-based schooling where the academics are fully integrated with all the social, emotional, and other health needs of kids, right? That's pillar one. Pillar two is around an educator development system commensurate with that type of schooling. The third pillar is the policies that need to follow. And the fourth pillar is the evidence-based storytelling and professional journalism that we need to inform and inspire others to take action.
Okay.
And so policies are going to be really important here. Incentives for, you know, first of all, for administrators to stay in rural communities. You just and not leave because of a shiny new job option. $10,000 more pay is available. So same thing for teachers too. We need policies to support compensation that are commensurate. So that's one area, but also policies that encourage disparate organizations, programs to work together. How about policies at our university that encourage joint appointments for those who work in the higher education, both not just the university, but let's say a community college, technical college, and a K-12 school.
Right, right.
Because if we're talking about de-siloing programs and people across those three different sectors, it sure would facilitate that de-siloing if folks who worked in them felt like they worked in all of them.
Right, and had privileges in all.
Correct.
And the resources available because of that.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So do you think it is reasonable or feasible to hold rural districts to different standards?
Well, I think there's some danger in that because we should have the same high expectations for every child. But I think how they get there and what it looks like needs to have some adaptation.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Because I know like for... you know, rural hospitals, for example, there are certain outcome measures that all hospitals have to follow unless you're a certain small size rural hospital that you're exempt.
Right.
Because they don't even have the resources to measure it or the volume to have a good measure for it.
Right.
So that kind of flexibility has been helpful, but at the same time, it calls into question quality, and it's just an
unknown. Equity too, right?
Equity, right, exactly. So those are trade-offs I think we always have to make with rural, under-resourced, lower population density areas.
Well, this may sound a bit trite, and I think it would work in almost any field, but an accountability system that only tells you what's right or what's wrong,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't also have enough information to tell you what you ought to do next,
right?
Then is an accountability system that's not worth its salt.
Right.
In education, in the K-12 world, basically we have accountability systems that basically are telling systems what's wrong and occasionally what a little bit's right. We don't have enough information in the system
mm-hmm.
to really guide the kind of actions for mm-hmm. improvement.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I think that we as a profession in the medical field struggle with is, you know, it's moving, it's changed rapidly, as you said, past even 10 years has changed, and 10 years from now it's going to be very different again. But yet many of our professionals are taught by older career professionals
mm.
who are kind of stuck in a older paradigm that no longer fits. I don't know if that is something that occurs in the educational field, if that is...
It does. It does. But the education field has a even a more difficult, and I'm channeling my old sociologist and mm-hmm. myself here, problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that most people want, and educators themselves, want schools to be a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Most parents want schools to be a lot better. Most politicians want schools to be a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem. They don't really want them to look any differently than they were when they themselves were students in those schools.
Right, right.
At least as a doctor, you didn't have 15,000 hours in a hospital as an apprentice
mm-hmm.
before you went to medical school.
Right, right.
But virtually every educator has had 15,000 hours, that do the math.
Right.
You know, 13 years, you know, 180 days, 7 hours a day.
Right,
And so they are so used to school as it was for them
right.
that they really don't want it to change too much.
Hard time seeing a different model.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the biggest challenge that we have in education
mm-hmm.
that you don't have in some other fields.
I know with my son's high school up here in Columbia, Irmo area, mm-hmm. they have... 2 blocks in the morning, 2 blocks in the afternoon, and an hour for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's like, wow, that's amazing. But I'm like, that's a small change.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like a big change. And everybody loves it. The teachers love it. The kids love it. Cause,
yep. It's an important change.
It's a small step.
Well, when you have, it gives you more time for interdisciplinary work.
Right.
Think about science. I mean, mm-hmm. how do you do something meaningful in science in a lab in 50 minutes?
Right, you can't. But if you've got 2.5 hours, you can.
Yes.
Right.
How do you give educators more control over that time,
right.
even inside of a larger building?
Right.
How do you think differently about the after-school program so the youth developers have time to work with the educators? So what happens between 7:30 and 3 and what happens from 3 till 8
right.
Take place? How do we build right. funding systems so that the school buildings, particularly in a place like Fairfield, are open? Not every building open, but open maybe
for other uses.
16 hours a day?
Right.
Why not?
Yeah, it's a community center.
Right. How do we take our public libraries and our school libraries as hubs right. of innovation? How do we begin to educate parents and kids simultaneously? A big issue.
Yeah.
In underserved rural communities.
Right. And I wonder too, you know, I've worked a lot with rural communities. I almost feel, and this is a feel, that some of these rural communities would be more open to those kinds of things because you can get literally all the decision makers in the same room.
Yes, and the ethos of family,
right.
Particularly in a community like Fairfield, that strong faith community behind them, and I can't say enough about J.R. Green, a superintendent who's been there 8 or 9 years now. Mm-hmm. He could go anywhere, but he's committed to that community. And the kind of faith that people have in him and the leadership he provides
mm-hmm.
and the willingness to think differently, to take a risk,
right.
to kind of jump in the deep end of the pool with us here at the university to try to see if we can figure this out.
Do something different.
Yeah, we don't know exactly what's going to happen next year.
Right.
Can you imagine going to a school system and saying,
We don't know what this is going to look like next year.
Can we figure this out together?
Yeah.
We say every day, All for SC is not a program. It is a strategy. It is an idea. And we hope at the university to be a catalyst for a good idea that folks of Fairfield own and lead.
So a couple of questions I always ask our guests. You know, one thing is, and I think you kind of hit on this, when we talk about rural undersourced, we tend to talk about barriers, problems, issues. But, you know, with the work you've done and just your travels, what have you seen that is good about being at a rural place? Positive.
Ethos of family and faith.
Okay.
Willingness to work together.
Mm.
Relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Trust.
Mm-hmm.
More likely to be there than not. Still lots of problems,
sure.
Lots of challenges in rural communities on all those fronts, I am certain.
But yeah.
It's much more easy to capture, captivate, and utilize.
Right. And then the big philosophical question is, how would you yourself define rural?
Not urban, not suburban.
Mm-hmm.
Population sparsity.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer opportunities.
Mm.
For health and advancement.
Mm-hmm.
It's as much, I think, a psychological dimension than a physical one.
Right.
Even though the Census Bureau and every other agency in the United States has some sort of definition.
They've got their metrics. Oh, yeah.
And they got their definition.
Oh, yeah.
I know it's not urban. And I know it's not suburban.
Mm-hmm.
And it has some mix of those other characteristics or issues that I just raised.
Right. Well, thanks for joining us. This conversation's been wonderful and sounds like really wonderful work that we're trying to do for the state and invest in.
Well, thanks for having me. I've had the good fortune in the last 6 months to get to know some of my medical school colleagues. I am really looking forward to learning even more about the work we're doing here and how we can work together.
Sounds great. For more information on some of the topics we talked about, check out the show notes. We'll have the links in there for various programs and your information so folks can find out more about you as well. That's it for today. Make sure you tune in for future episodes. If you have ideas for guests we should have on our podcast, please reach out. We'd love to hear from you. So until next time, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to the Growing Rural Podcast. If you found the content valuable, please leave a rating on iTunes or Spotify so others can find us. For more information, please visit our website at sc.edu/ruralhealthcare or follow us on Twitter at sc_CRPH. This was recorded at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Columbia. It is edited and produced by Sean Riffle. Y'all take care.